KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a discussion entitled Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World on Tuesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland. In Oregon, as in other places, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia have intersected to perpetuate white supremacist and white nationalist ideology. This panel discussion will explain those connections and will offer tools that individuals and communities can employ to help stop the spread of hate culture. Again, that is a discussion on Islamophobia and white nationalism in Oregon and the world on Tuesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, and welcome to Popular Education. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 7:02. Thank you so much for joining me. This is our third episode, and tonight we have Michael with us. Hey, Michael, how's it going?
How you doing? Hello.
Hey, it's fantastic to have you here. For those of you who might not know, Michael is also a local DJ here on KBOO for Urban Funk every first Thursday.
That's correct.
He's a comedian, actor, and an active member of Portland art community. Excuse me.
I'm flattered that you called me an actor. I'm completely. You took my breath away. Thank you. I appreciate that. Tammy is so kind.
Oh, that's what compliments and friends and community members are for, you know, to see and show you what you might not see for yourself.
Thank you. No doubt. I'm also a DJ over at Freeform. I do the program Urban Human Being. That's every Monday from 12 to 2 p.m. And also, I am active in the improv community. I'm heavily into the theater scene. And things of that nature. Yes.
Yes. Appreciate you being here. And today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different. I got the pleasure of meeting you here at KBOO, and through our conversation and just talking to one another, we got to talking about some of your history and things that you've done in the past. And today I want to talk to you about your experience as a mental health therapist for a psychiatric intake facility in New York. Tell me about that. How was that like? How did you manage to do that?
Well, it's always been my passion to help people. It's just been something that was instilled into me at a young age. And through the different channels, I found myself working with people who were experiencing problems mentally. I was fortunate enough to take an exam, pass the training, and I was hired as a mental health therapy aide for a New York State mental hospital. And as an intake specialist, it's difficult dealing with the amount of people who come in who, it's amazing how many people are suffering from mental health issues and who are able to just walk in. Some have to be escorted, but a majority of the people were voluntarily walking into the hospital.
And when we were talking about it earlier, I was asking you if it was kind of like an emergency room situation. And then, you know, just after I asked that, I realized, well, you know, if someone is suffering from a mental health episode, that is an emergency for them at that moment, you know. So in order to cope with that and to actually give proper care for people that were looking for it, what kind of training, or did you have any kind of special training for the position? And did the training actually... was it sufficient for a real life application?
Fortunately for me, I had worked with the developmentally disabled. And as I said before, at a young age, I was instilled with working with people. So that was something that came pretty much naturally. But with the training is valuable. The training is essential. You need to be able to separate yourself. There's a lot of things that you may or may not be able to deal with personally when dealing with someone with a mental illness. So you have to be trained in order to know how to dissect and analyze and identify these problems and kind of like separate yourself. So it does take training.
Yeah. And yeah, I can't even imagine what that would be on a day to day from seeing people of all, you know, mental illness doesn't separate, you know, it doesn't see color, race, you know, yeah, gender, class, anything.
It's, I mean, on a daily basis, our intake was probably 20 people a day.
Jeez.
And that was just, it was a section of the city, even though it was intended for the entire city, but you would have to break it down into sections where certain people would be taken to this hospital in this geographic area and certain people would go to this hospital in this geographic area because the population is so wide and so many people. And then when you, the saying that we have is if you need help, ask, you know, seek help. So a lot of these people who are showing up at these emergency rooms are seeking help. So once they pass that stage of, okay, well, this is something that's either short-term, inpatient, or something that we can treat, you know, quickly. So there's a period of time that you have to process all of that information as well.
Yeah, like you said, dissect and analyze exactly what kind of treatment the person needs. And what were, so this was in, you said late 80s, early 90s in New York.
Yeah, from 1986, 87 to 1994.
Okay, so what kind of treatment was available for patients back then?
Most of the time, initially, the thing is to identify the patient and to find out if the patient is on any medications. Once you find out what medications the patient is on, that's part of a way that you can find out what illness the person is suffering from. Once you find out what the person is suffering from, then you have to go forth and try to help that situation, try to help that person deal with whatever it is. And it's a wide range. It can be anything from street addiction to crisis in the family or a sudden encounter. You mentioned earlier, mental illness, it has no limit. It doesn't care what race you are. It doesn't care your age or, you know, it happens to anyone at any time.
Yeah. And, so once people were admitted, what was the time frame that you would get to actually talk to the people, or was it really kind of like a in and out, get you where you need to get situated and move on to the next person?
It's a variation. Once again, it's like it could be a person that's just feeling depressed, just feeling down. You know, you want someone to talk to a person who is seeing things that are not there and could be violent toward themselves and toward others. Those situations you have to take seriously. You have to consider the impact that situation can have. And if you let that person just walk out, what are the repercussions of that person walking amongst other people after they had made that statement, something threatening towards someone or themselves? So those are the things, that's the impact that you have to deal with if you're dealing with someone who's just feeling blue, just feeling a little sad, and they need someone to talk to, opposed to someone who could be extremely violent, unpredictable, and, you know, moody. So you don't really know.
So like you mentioned, we said earlier that mental health doesn't discriminate. However, there are people that have the means to take care of themselves versus a lot of people from unprotected communities that don't have these means. I have this clip that I want to play for you, and it's from the documentary called On the Ground. It's a piece of audio from the documentary that was shot with the direction of Sisters of the Road, community members, and Portland's Balanced Media Film Production.
someone is homeless must have been done something bad to be homeless. And this is not the truth. I try to start my day with a positive thought. Picking a word, you know, like, we'll say perseverance. And, you know, meditate with what are these things that embody that. I got this feeling in me that says I'm going to be homeless forever. And it's like, okay, maybe that's not necessarily true. You know, trying to keep that thing from beating me up. I find when I meditate, it helps achieve some serenity. And you know, I'm going to try and keep going and raise myself. I've been sober for 8 years. A lot of people think, oh, you go quit doing drugs and alcohol, and bing, you're back to this perfect person that you always were. I'm still me. I still have my mental health problems, so, and I have to face those.
Spending any amount of time outside means you're going to be subject to a tremendous amount of traumatic encounters with law enforcement, with other houseless people, with the house community that's just really unhappy with your presence.
The traumatic part of being homeless is, you know, the mental wear that happens to you is intense. I mean, you're just really are so marginalized that your life isn't worth anything. You can be assaulted on the street by another homeless person and nothing's going to be done for that. That's just the way it is.
It leads to deterioration of mental health that I think no person experiencing any length of houselessness can avoid.
So in that clip, we were listening again to On the Ground. That is a documentary that was shot and directed by Sisters of the Road community members. And here we had someone who was speaking about facing his mental illnesses while being homeless, as well as the mental trauma that the houseless community members face. So coming back to you, Michael, what was the climate and social sentiment around mental health and its effect on the houseless community during the time when you were working at the hospital?
Houseless and homeless community was the most popular. I don't want to use popular, but that population was larger than any other cases that we were experiencing in the mental facility. That those patients were outnumbered everyone else. And listening to the clip, those statements are very strong and very powerful, and it's something to consider. A person who usually take their medication to help them deal with issues that they're experiencing, and living on the street, not being able to access those valuable and those important medications to help this person deal with it, is a lot. And also mentioning the assaults and the harassment by police officers and the assaults by other people who are homeless and houseless, that is also what comes into play when people are admitted into the hospital because they've been assaulted, they've been abused, they're experiencing trauma. They may lash out. They may become violent.
And why wouldn't they? It's just how much can a person,
you know,
deal with?
It's 24 hours, yeah. 7 days a week, no matter what the weather is, you're out there in the elements.
All of the elements, in the freezing and in the recent polar vortex.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that had to endure that.
So I felt really compelled. I actually felt like I was doing something. I felt like I was doing something very important to our community and to our society, because these people were ignored. These people are targeted. These people are abused. These people are us. It's not them and us. It's, these are our people. These are our family members. These are our loved ones. These are our friends that fall upon hard times and they find themselves without a place to live.
And as far as the public sentiment during that time, were people, just the public during that time, were they, was that conversation happening about the relations between mental health, the coverage that people need, houseless community, and the effects that it has on the people?
It's different in each city. In New York, they actually do have a system in place where they don't allow homeless people to dwell in places that are not safe and that are not a place to dorm. And that helps to kind of like sort out people who are in need of help. You actually get that contact because you need to be able to not allow someone with a mental illness to just dwell without any kind of assistance or supervision under these conditions.
So how would members of the like different unprotected communities get treatment? Was it mostly, unfortunately, through police involvement, or did you find that, and again, you know, it's the houseless population, of course, but as well as, let's say, uninsured people or just people who don't have the means to take care of, you know, have preventative health of some sort. So how would unprotected community members be able to get treatment?
In that city, it would unfortunately be law enforcement to initiate that treatment. Under those conditions, law enforcement is in that state of New York. They are pretty much forced to take that person to a hospital. For example, if a person was doing something dangerous in public, in a public setting, they would be forced to take that person to a hospital immediately. It wouldn't be a case where arrest or any kind of legal action would be taken against that person. And it's pretty sad to wait to that point that someone would have to be that out and have to make that big of a scene in order to get that help.
So you have to get pushed to that point where that's the only.
Yeah, it's it, that's not. I, yeah. In my opinion, I just don't see that as the way to go.
That being that the point, like the breaking point of when people are, when I guess the public, because you know that's when it's visible for people in law enforcement that someone is having an episode or having an issue, is when they are acting out. And so why does it have to get to that point that we actually care and do something and give someone treatment? So that's definitely something that I personally also agree with you. And so during, you mentioned now that in New York they would have laws kind of telling houseless people in the houseless community of where it's not safe and where areas where they can get help when they need it. What kind of issues did you see would come up a lot with the houseless community members and people that were kind of maybe taking advantages of some services? Because you didn't mention that there was the identity law, so I thought that was a fascinating thing, if you could mention that a little bit.
Well, as you know, with any system, you have people who would extend it and take liberties with the system that it's not intended for. In doing that, you would find in the houseless community, a lot of people don't have identification. So once they are admitted into the hospital, it's important to identify these people for various reasons, for contacting the family, the medical history.
Which is exactly what you were doing as the intake.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And then you would find people who would come into the system and hide under the radar and not be properly identified. They would take on a new identity. And this was pretty dangerous. I would say that you would have a person who that was their whole intention on getting a new identity to hide from whatever it was that they were trying to do, whatever past or whatever the case. It was just basically
using the system. Yeah, using the system that was instilled for people in need and just taking advantage of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, in that sense, it's like, who is to say that, you know, this person doesn't need help in the same way, but it probably need help in a different way. But initially, the system was put into place where they do have a system where you can actually walk into the clinic and volunteer and say you need help. And, you know, it was the door open system. And it wasn't something that was entirely for people being brought in by police mm-hmm. escort. You would find people who, like I said, they weren't feeling good today. They weren't up to the task of dealing with the day-to-day. And people come to their breaking point. And these are the things that we have to pay attention to. We have to pay attention to our mental health. We take care of our bodies. We take care of our skin and our hair. But mental health is something that's extremely important, and we need to take care of that, because these are the moments that could change our lives if we don't take heed to them. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's quite a blessing to be able to recognize your when you're triggered, or when you're about to feel something coming upon you, and being able to reach for that help when it's available. So one question, this is actually from a listener, and they want to know, how did the federal and state policies change during your time there, and how did it affect the actual facility itself?
They got a new governor. Once they got the new governor in place, everything changed. They developed something that's been taking over the entire nation, and that's DNA. Hmm. And DNA testing would be the ultimate identity. So you couldn't hide underneath the radar and admit yourself into a hospital trying to get away from whatever it was, DNA testing policies. And it varies from state to state. I mean, in Florida, they don't have a psychiatric center. Basically, a lot of states just
in Florida.
Yeah.
In Florida. That's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of places just don't have any interest in helping. That's the only way I can see it. They have no interest in helping people with psychiatric problems or people with mental illness. They have no interest in it, because you have to have these things in place for people who need help.
Yeah, that's, and especially since all the time you're reading Florida Man eats other man's face, that's, you know, I think that there's definitely maybe something that needs to,
I mean, I'm sorry I blew it up, but there's a couple of states that just, I mean, like, yeah,
just complete negligence for the population.
I mean, it's straight from, you know, whatever experience that you're going to, mm-hmm. straight to a holding pen.
Yeah.
And or straight to jail.
Just not interested in rehabilitating people.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's unfortunate. Reading the articles and dealing with what's going on here in Portland as well, it's like having something in place to deal with people who's experiencing mental trauma and having a mental episode. There's a difference between a person having a mental episode and a person who is extremely violent, and only a person who is trained can see that difference in those two.
Exactly.
And it's totally different approach.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the bodies that do handle mental episodes, mental trauma, or like mental health episodes, are not necessarily properly trained in identifying and assessing the situation without exerting force. So that's definitely something that we're going to talk about a little later on. And so, oh, Mike, thank you so much for being here today with us.
Of course.
Really appreciate it.
I love being here with you, Tammy. It's been a pleasure, and I really enjoy what we're doing tonight.
Oh,
I think this is very important. This is very dear to me. Mental health is something that I've been dealing with my entire life, and I'm sure a lot of other people are dealing with this, and we have to stop Making people feel bad.
Oh yeah.
About
definitely.
How they feel. You can't make a person feel better if you're making them feel bad.
Oh no. Oh no. And a lot of great there are great people that have gone through tremendous hardships in their lives, from houselessness to mental illness to just being, you know, person of color in America, for example. And so part of the show is also a little bit of music. So it is a hybrid show. And like I mentioned, Mike does do a radio music show first Thursdays. So you should check it out. So this time I get, since I engineer for his show, I get to play some music for you this time.
Thank you. I want to hear what you got to play.
I think you're actually going to really, really enjoy this one. Here's our first one. Hope you enjoy as well.
I feel Ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweaters, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no love, ain't got no faith. I ain't got no culture, ain't got no mother, ain't got no father, ain't got no brother, ain't got no children, ain't got no aunts, ain't got no uncles, ain't got no love, ain't got no mind. I ain't got no country, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no friends,
thank you so much for joining us. We are here at KBOO, and you're listening to Popular Education. My name is Tammy, and...
Michael.
Hey, how's it going? Michael,
how
is...
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. He's my guest tonight. And you were just listening to Charles Bradley with Changes. That was the first song. I chose that song because he actually experienced houselessness as well before joining the Job Corps, I believe. And then the queen herself, Nina Simone, with... Ain't Got No. That was such a great song. Thank you so much for being here, Michael.
I thank you for having me.
Not
I appreciate you so much. And the good people at KBOO, appreciate you as well.
Yes. And going back to our subject, Michael is here, and he's talking to us about his time as a mental health therapist for a psychiatric intake facility in New York. We mentioned a bunch of different things, and we're just going to jump right back into it. So fast forwarding to now, 2019 here in Portland, in your opinion, how is the conversation around linking mental health and houselessness progressed over the years?
Honestly, I haven't seen much progression as far as what steps need to be taken in order to help prevent it, or at least make it shorter, something that it's temporary, because any extended period of time without a residence, without a shelter, food, proper nourishment, sometimes medication, that is not a healthy condition for any human being. So we should have been propelled into the future with how we deal with this situation, because it's been around long enough. and we should have a full understanding of what it is, how we can prevent it, how we can delay it, some way to execute a system.
Yeah, and then like you mentioned, the elements of being outside when you are houseless, and I mean, it just exacerbates mental health and unfortunately, the decay of a person's mental health from having to deal with the elements.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things from your physical health to your mental health to your emotional health.
And safety, too.
And your safety.
Because that's all it's, you know, your health is your safety.
When you think about confrontation and situations around town, I mean, what affects that? Does the homeless and houseless population have on the rest of the community? You know, people who live in the areas where people are setting up camps, crime, burglary, you know, trespass, these things are coming up more often when you have a population that's growing in a system that is not addressing the problem.
And there are a lot, I'm really glad that you highlighted that, because there are a lot of local efforts and organizations and nonprofits that do a lot of work to kind of reclaim the houseless community's reputation almost, you know, because they get, their voice is barely heard. And when it is, it's amplified through a microphone that isn't even, you know, not held by them, let alone really, you know, saying how they feel. And I know there are a lot of different organizations, and also on KBOO, there's a Right to Survive. They do a lot of really great in-depth and also on the ground direct action. What are your, and we were talking earlier about the differences that you see in how the general public in Portland, Oregon addresses the houseless population versus in New York on a more of a policy and local state authority kind of level. So from your impressions, from the local efforts that provide mental health treatments to unprotected communities, to the actual way that community, that we as Portlanders react to the houseless population, what are your impressions?
Dealing with a problem that's a community problem takes the entire community. Mm-hmm. It's not one agency. There's not one agency that's responsible for it. It's a community issue. A collaboration of different sources, outsources, can come together to kind of like view the whole situation to come up with a solution. There are, as you said, here at KBOO and other organizations who are trying to make efforts toward a change in the homeless population, houseless population, their presence in our community, trying to change that and trying to help them. And it's not entirely being met by all the necessary chapters that and channels that need to come together.
There are very few organizations, and the ones that do, they're very proud of being actually housing people, for example, and providing the tools for someone to create a tiny home and providing the tools for tiny home villages. And there are very, very few organizations that actually do that. And the ones that do, they're the ones that are making the change.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I see, okay, say for instance, like you said, there are organizations that will help you set up a tiny home, a place that you can dwell that's a single person and you can dwell there to try to work yourself to get yourself to where you need to be. Then you set up a program, some kind of job, technical, some kind of outsource program that'll help this person get the tools in order to survive or whatever they have to do vocationally to get themselves to where they need to be. And then you have another source that will be able to, a person that is on some sort of medication, an outpatient clinic or outpatient place where a person can check in. And if they need some kind of mental help or resources, that is the place that they can go. So it's a collective thing. I mean, It's great that you get and it's no, please, it's no disrespect to anyone, because everything matters. Everyone matters. Every effort that someone puts toward helping someone matters. And I want to make that clear. But there's a little bit more to just giving a person a sandwich and giving them something to drink. I mean, that's a start. You know, that's definitely a start, but it has to be a little bit more. It has to be, and it's a balance. If you're just giving out these resources to people who need the help, opposed to the people who are not utilizing the system properly, you know, it's that balance as well. So these are all of the things that have to be taken into account. It can't be just a knee jerk, like, we just want to help them and that's it. You have to really know where the help is coming from and how the help is going to help and where we're going to go with it.
To invoke actual change exactly. That can last the difference between influence and actual power. And I can't, you know, the people that deal and work and are activists in the houseless crisis in Portland, and then the mental health crisis that's, you know, like you said, that you see it looming over the city, the people that deal with it, they have a lot of things that they have to take into consideration. Like you were saying, you know, when you were doing the intake, there are just so many different levels to just dealing with one patient, and that's just one person. Yeah. And that person has to deal, then go to an agency that now only cares about them from 5 to 9, you know, if even then, for like 10 minutes of 8 hours a day. And I wanted to ask you, when you were working as a therapist, what agencies did you find to really impact people's lives, to really help them?
Honestly, a lot of the religious organizations, they were more than helpful in certain areas as much as possible. That is something that you will find a lot of if you seeking help. A lot of the religious organizations will pop up, and that's an help. That's definitely a step in the right direction, and it has to be met. There is plenty of organizations that are interested in trying to extend more help, but policies, laws, you know, whatever they have of restrictions on people living and sleeping on properties and, you know, things of that nature. It's always those technicalities that people have to get around. So maybe our people in office, Congress people, can kind of chime in and kind of make it a little simpler for people to get help. Because this is, like I said, it's not something that one organization or agency can handle. And living in Portland, I've been living in Portland for 2 years, and I've seen very little progress in how the homeless population is being dealt with. And as I said before, it's not to put anything bad on any organization or people who are out here really working hard to make a difference. We all need help. We all have to come together and try to combat this problem, because you never know when it could happen to you.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I just want to mention, that under capitalism, one bad day can cause your whole life to spiral completely out of your control. Losing your job, a diagnosis of an illness, a natural disaster like we saw from Katrina, an economic crash in 08, any kind of unfortunate emergency can cause a person to lose everything that they've gained. And so to think that, since most of us are living paycheck to paycheck, you know, most of us are not, if something happens to us, a traumatic event happens in our lives, we're not ready to reap the repercussions.
Yeah, I mean, like, in what you just read it out loud, and just thinking about that when you read it, I was like, wow, I kind of feel bad. And it's like, you know, you experience a natural disaster, and then you have no home, and now you're homeless, and yeah, guess what's next?
Yeah,
mental illness.
Yeah, exactly. It's right around the corner. That's just too much
right
to deal
there.
With. Yeah,
it's a lot of it's a domino effect, and anyone can experience. So that's why it's important for all of us to take notice of this.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, kind of trying and prepare in a, when I was prepping for the show, I just trying to read the causes, trying to find the data, just trying to find like some sort of common or link or something. But it just, any one bad day, just anything can happen, and you're just, your whole life is ruined. And that's unfortunately just the way that it is under capitalism and the way that we're living now. You did mention one thing, and I'm so glad that you did. It's a good way to kind
just
of,
one thing?
One of the many things that you had mentioned was the national level and what our Congress folks can do for us. And so I actually got to speak to our third district congressperson, and it was a fantastic interview, but that's not what I'm going to play. Right now, I just want to play a little clip of Dr. Susan Rogers from the Physicians for a National Health Program. She's going to be talking about the Medicare for All Act.
Hello, my name is Dr. Susan Rogers. I'm a retired general internist from the John H. Stroger Hospital in Chicago, Illinois. I want to make a few comments about the health inequities and disparities that currently exist in our country. Right now, we have a healthcare system that is fragmented, inefficient, and totally not sustainable. The number of poverty-stricken neighborhoods in this country has doubled over the last 20 years, and this has disproportionately affected people of color. Within those communities, there are often medical deserts. Hospitals have closed, pharmacies have closed, there aren't as many clinics, so that access to care becomes a major issue. In this country, we have phenomenal resources. We have technology and medical innovation that rivals any other country. However, like I mentioned, we have neighborhoods where there are medical deserts, where access to basic care to treat common problems does not exist. The financing of our current system contributes to this, as healthcare is developed in area in neighborhoods where a profit can be made versus where healthcare is needed. Medicare for All will help change that, in that it will provide healthcare to everyone. Medicare for All says that healthcare is a right. Everyone is entitled to health care, regardless of their socioeconomic status, their ability to pay, or their ethnic history and background. By providing health care in all neighborhoods, the access to care will then be much, much better and easier for all to avail themselves. It will no longer be placed in areas where there a profit can be made. It will be placed in areas where health care is needed. It is important that we support Medicare for All so that we can provide access to everyone who lives here. Now, providing access, I know, will not solve all health care disparities. However, it is an important tool if we are to address this. I support Medicare for All. I hope you will too.
So, like I mentioned, that was Dr. Susan Rogers from the PNHP talking about the Medicare for All Act. So on a national level, many members of Congress are pushing for the Medicare for All Act, which aims to kind of bridge the gap for folks who couldn't and still aren't receiving the guaranteed coverage under the Obamacare. So the bill, I'm not going to get too specific into it, but it does call that all U.S. residents are going to be covered under the bill and provide for automatic enrollments for individual upon birth or residency in the United States. So what are your opinions about that? It's not, you know, approved or anything yet. It just came, I think, on the 27th of April. That's when that draft was handed to Congress. What are your opinions about that?
It may not be popular in this day and age, but my opinion is it's a fantastic idea. I think it's a bold statement, and mm-hmm. I approve it 100%. There should be no limitation. There should be no restriction. There should be no doubt that if you need help, you get it. No questions asked.
Yeah.
And there's nothing. There is so much. When we think about all the things that happen in the world and things that could have been prevented, or if we take into consideration the people that could have been helped, it's a lot of the time we look at the mental illness factor, and it can be, a lot of things can be prevented when treated properly. And a lot of situations that we experience, a lot of the catastrophes that happen, I don't want to really claim any professional viewpoint, but I mean, like, it's just simple to understand that if you can prevent it, if a person has access to the necessary resources that they need, and they don't have to worry about, well, you know, I don't have money or I can't afford it. I mean, this is necessary. Yeah, this is a very necessary thing.
And it doesn't just start and end with mental illness. It's also physical ailments. You know, people just, and again, under capitalism, you got to work hard if you want to make money. And working hard causes, you know, physical ailments. And if you don't get them treated, then after a while, it's going to turn more serious. Preventative medicine is definitely very important.
And I like to point out what the doctor had mentioned. I like to point out as well, mental illness amongst African Americans, amongst Black people, it's a whole different level.
Oh yeah,
we experience a different trauma, and it's necessary for us to take care of our mental illness. And I know traditionally, this is the stigma that we have, that we don't want to look for help. We don't need help. We don't do that. Yes, we do. Everyone needs help. So we have to address that, and we have to stop that stigma in our community. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the Black community. Mm-hmm. We have mental illness as well, and we have to address that.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you said that. And from Congress folks to individual activists to organizations to churches, there are a lot of people on local and national level that are doing a lot. I'd really like to say thank you.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate your time. I'm so glad that I got the chance to talk with you. If you or anyone that you know wants to be a part of making your community better and safer for everyone, there's some great local organizations that are spearheading housing reform. You have Street Roots. They create employment opportunities for people experiencing houselessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media catalysts. Like I mentioned, Right to Survive, every second Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7, Right to Survive hosts a program on KBOO confronting the housing crisis. And then there's also Food Not Bombs. There's a Portland chapter. They are on the Facebook. And of course, Sister of the Roads. They do so much fantastic stuff. And you can volunteer over there and help them with their systematic change program, which also encompasses farming, which is so important to be able to sustain yourself, help yourself. I'd really like to thank everyone for listening. It's really great to have you here listening to us. It's really great to have Michael here at the studio with me. I have such a great time doing this. And if you have any questions, comments, want to talk about certain things or have any subjects that you want us to cover here at Popular Education on KBOO, you can send me an email, populareducationradio@gmail.com. I'd like you to remember that we're all in this together, and we are all that we have. So try to take care of one another. Freedom is all I ever had.
atomic energy. Cause none of them are gonna stop off the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. Won't you ask the same? Jesus of freedom, that's all I ever had. Redemption song, all I ever had. Redemption.
It is 8 p.m. in the PDX Portland area, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. Stay tuned for Ear to the Streets, coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a discussion entitled Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World on Tuesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland. In Oregon, as in other places, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia have intersected to perpetuate white supremacist and white nationalist ideology. This panel discussion will explain those connections and will offer tools that individuals and communities can employ to help stop the spread of hate culture. Again, that is a discussion on Islamophobia and